Hello everyone, good afternoon and welcome to Easter Hack. And today I'm delighted to share with you my project that I built called Radar, which was created to deal with limitations and inefficiencies with existing tools when it comes to testing web authentication. Radar has changed the way I approach HTTP testing, and today I'm going to show you how. Here's the agenda for today's talk. I will start with an introduction to talk about the origins of Radar and the problem it was created to solve. Then I will go into the methodology, explaining the basic core concepts in Radar and its architecture, how it works, and what makes it different from other tools. Then I will showcase you some live demos, which will hopefully convince you to give it a try as well. And I will end the presentation with short conclusions and the Q&A session. Now, let me introduce myself before I begin. I'm Daniel. I've been a penetration tester for more than 5 years. For the last year, a little bit longer, I've been working at Acodis, previously known as Modis. And I have 5 more years experience working in IT, mostly as a sysadmin. I started building Radar about 2 years ago, and later the same year, it became a part of OWASP. And I'm still working on this project until now. So what is Radar? When I was brainstorming with a friend the title for this presentation, I came up with this. OWASP Radar, a novel framework for manipulating HTTP processes of persisting sessions. This sounds complicated. We are bad naming things, and I hope by the next time I will have a much shorter title to actually describe it. But for now, bear with me. So Radar was basically incepted with a goal to help make web authentication testing easier. But it has come a long way, it has evolved by now, and can be used for all kinds of HTTP processes of arbitrary complexity. How does it work? Basically, it defines a new DSL, which is a domain-specific language, in contrast with GPL, general programming languages like Python, Java, and so on. And it uses this DSL to describe the client-server information exchange. It's also built with modularity in mind. So, since it's impossible to build a tool that will cover all your future needs, Radar takes that into account. And the users can write their own code to extend Radar. So the core, the main core, is written in Python, while the configuration files are written in a little-known language called Hilang, or Hi, which is a Lisp dialect on top of Python. And I will describe my design decisions in a later slide. Now let's talk about the problem. When I was testing the authentication with the barb suit, I ended up with something like you can see in the screenshot. Basically, I had a bunch of poorly organized repeater tabs. So my process was as follows. I had to go to the first step of the process, do some modifications to the request, send the request, go look into the response body, find some piece of information, copy it, go to the barb suit's decoder, encoder, modify it as necessary, then come back to the repeater, paste it into the right spot for the next step of the process, and so on. And I had to repeat this for every single step of the process, which can become frustrating. And it's also error-prone if you copy one character less, for example. I needed a much more flexible solution with fewer clicks. Once you understand how the authentication works, you usually want to automate it, or at least parts of it. With barb suit, this can be done with so-called barb suit macros. And they work for simple cases when you want to extract some information from a previous request and put it into the next one, you can only extract based by some static strings or regular expressions. This will fall short if you need something more complex. Let's say you need to send the one-time password, the generated one-time password from a secret, or you want to run some other arbitrary actions. In this case, burp suit macros will not help you that much. You might be able to achieve this using writing your own custom burp suit extensions, but this is also, again, not a very flexible solution. Now let's look at how ZapProxy automates authentication. Here you can see you need to configure the so-called context in order to enable authentication, and you choose from some predefined authentication types. Then you need to set up the pattern to detect when the request is logged in and when it's logged out. Also, you might need to configure the actual users and the session management parameters. And while this looks trivial, in practice, it's not that trivial to set up. It's also very hard to debug when it's not working properly. And the most important of it all, this will only help you if you want to automate the authentication part in ZapProxy. It will not help you if you want to test the authentication process itself. It's worth mentioning ZapProxy also provides us with some so-called authentication scripts, which in theory could be used to automate all kinds of authentication. However, they can run only inside those contexts, which I've shown in the previous slide. You cannot run those scripts standalone. So that was a deal breaker for me, because I was particularly interested in the authentication, in testing authentication itself. ZapProxy also comes with the so-called Zest scripts, which is an interesting feature. It's the closest to what I actually wanted to have when I was building Radar. However, it has some pretty big limitations, and I believe it's because of its configuration file being written in static JSON. The earlier Radar prototypes were also using JSON configuration, but very soon I found out that it does not allow me to have the flexibility that I wanted with Radar. And I'm going to explain those JSON issues in a later slide. The challenges with authentication are well known in the ZapProxy community. Here you can see a screenshot from their web page, which advises you to disable or simplify the authentication when testing to make your life easier. However, this is a disappointment, especially if you are particularly interested in testing the authentication process itself, like I was. In this case, the tools such as ZapProxy and Burp Suit will not help you that much. So, now let's talk about JSON. As I said, the early Radar prototypes were also using JSON for its configuration. Turns out, JSON files get large and complicated fast. Editing them manually is painful, and it quickly becomes awkward when you have a lot of requests and responses. You also need some special syntax to reference previously defined items. You also need another syntax to process items, to encode, decode, do some string manipulations, and so on. And also, you cannot really easily reuse parts of the JSON that you've defined before. And all of those issues could be easily solved if we had real code instead of static JSON configuration file. Which brings us to the interesting part. Why Lisp? To most people, Lisp is an ancient language which does not have much real-world usage today. However, Lisp languages are ideal for creating your own custom DSLs, domain-specific languages. One of the main reasons why it's so useful for my particular task for Radar is because of the concept so-called homo iconicity, which is also called code is data and data is code. A programming language is homo iconic when the internal representation of the program can be manipulated as data using the language itself. So the program is treated like a regular data structure, and this gives the users the power of metaprogramming. So basically, you write Lisp macros, which look like regular functions, but they're not. They do not return a value. They return pieces of code, which is why it's metaprogramming. You write code that generates or manipulates other code. And This is very useful to abstract away boilerplate code, to automate some tasks. And that's really important for configuration files, because you don't want to repeat yourself. You want to make it reusable and to make it more easily maintainable, the code. And before I move to the next slide, I wanted to tell you my story with Lisp. I began using Emacs more than 10 years ago. I've still used Vim before that, and I still use Vim nowadays for some tasks, but I fell in love with Emacs extensibility, how easy it is to change it. It does not feel like a text editor to me, not even an IDE. It mostly feels like an operating system, a text-based operating system. Nowadays, I use most of my time inside Emacs. And it's not just for coding, it's also for managing my tasks and goals, for reading my emails, reading news articles, and so on. I even wrote this presentation using Emacs org mode by exporting it with LaTeX Beamer. So, why am I telling you this? For many years, my main issue with Emacs was its configuration file, which is written in eLisp, Emacs dialect for Lisp. I really wish that I could configure it using Python, which is my main language. But when I was battling the JSON issues I described in the previous slide, at some point it finally clicked. I finally started understanding why do we need the Lisp and all those things. So basically, I had to write configuration files, which is data. But I also needed to contain code. I could have invented a new way to do that, but why bother if Lisp is here? So I started playing with the Lisp in Rider, and slowly I started understanding why do we need all those ugly parentheses in Lisp? They're not for us humans, they're for the machine. We humans are supposed to ignore them and focus on the code and its indentation. It all started slowly make sense. Macro started to make sense, and I couldn't wait out to try it all out in Rader. By now it's clear, I hope, why Lisp, but why Highlang? Well, the most important reason is because it compiles into Python code. You can still access all of your Python libraries, which is super important, especially in the security field, where so many tools and libraries are already written in Python. So Highlang combines the flexibility of Lisp with the power of Python. And it's also relatively easy to learn if you know Python. It's basically just Python code written with Lisp syntax. Now, since we covered the basics, let's go into the details. In my experience, a lot of pen testers see the authentication part of the application as a black box. They assume this part is safe, and they don't try to look at it that much. Which is a shame, because it causes many bugs to get overlooked. And with this talk, and Rader in particular, I aim to make it easier for people to understand and test complex HTTP processes, like authentication, but not limited to that. So now I'm going to show you some techniques on how to reverse engineer such complex processes, like the authentication. So here you can see a screenshot of Mitem proxy, which is another proxy tool. And I captured all the traffic that's being generated while logging in on Reddit. And as you can see, there are 392 requests here. Most of those are not relevant. So we need to remove everything which is not. Those are mostly JavaScript file, images, videos, and so on. So after we remove all those unnecessary ones, we are left with something that is much easier to digest. But it's still not all of those requests are relevant. We need to figure out how the authentication works, which ones are relevant, which are not, and so on. One way to do this would be to start from the beginning, from the first request, and trace back all of the inputs and outputs being used and generated until the end. However, this is not always the most efficient way, because you can get sidetracked. It's very easy to assume that some cookie or some header is relevant in the process, while in reality it's not. And sometimes it's easier if you start from the end. So you pick one request, which only works if the user is authenticated. It should fail otherwise. And go back from there. So here's how one such request looks like. And here you can see there are several blurred fields in the headers, which could all potentially be used to identify the user. Now, we need to figure out which ones of those are important. How do we do that? We remove everything piece by piece until we arrive at the simplest request possible, which still gives us back the authenticated result. And here's what I came up with. The first two headers, host and user agent, are required by the HTTP protocol, so those are not relevant here. The three ones highlighted in red are generated automatically by Python request library, so those can also be ignored. So this means we have only one piece of information which identifies us in this request. And this is the authorization bearer token. So for this particular endpoint, we only need this one input to identify us. But how do we get it? Well, we search the traffic for this particular string and identify the first request, which gives us back this token in the response. And here's what I found. On the left side, you can see the request. On the right side, it's the response body. And this access token is hidden somewhere deep inside the response body. And this is the only output that we need from this particular information exchange. But what are the inputs? Here you can see again there's some few blurred fields which can also potentially be used. And we do the same thing again. We remove everything piece by piece until we arrive at the simplest request possible, which still returns us back this access token in the response. That's how you reverse engineer such processes. And there are more details to it. I'm not going to show you everything until the end for Reddit authentication. I'm just showing you some techniques. But now I need to focus on Radar. So now let's talk about finite state machines. Finite state machines are a mathematical model of computation that allows you to analyze complex computer systems. So a system is stateful if it remembers the preceding events. For example, HTTP protocol, it's stateless. Each HTTP request is independent from the other ones, while the authentication process is stateful, because you need to complete every single step of the process in the right order, and actually, in order to get actually authenticated. This state is the information which you remember about the system. And the system can be in only one of its finite number of states at any given time. And the so-called mealy finite state machines can be used best to model the authentication systems. And we can have multiple inputs, multiple outputs, and the output values are determined both by the current state and its inputs. And here's how one such single state would look like with its inputs and outputs if we model the authentication process using finite state machine. So in this case, we have three inputs, the username, password, and CSRF token. The server verifies them and returns us back some cookies. To model the entire authentication from the beginning to the end, we need to chain multiple such steps together. And Here you can see a simplified diagram of how that would look like, with each state having its inputs and outputs hidden, because otherwise it would get too complicated to put it here. So basically, we start with an unauthenticated state. We open the login web page, we send the credentials, the server checks them. If they're wrong, we go to the login failed state. If they're correct, the multi-factor authentication is checked, if it's enabled or not. If it's disabled, we go straight to authenticated. If it's enabled, we go through one more step. And the server checks the code and sends us back respectively, either failed or passed. That's basically it. That's how you model the authentication system using finite state machines. Now, how do we do this with Radar? The so-called Radar flows are basic building blocks in Radar, and they are used to describe the information exchange during one single step of the process. So you have one single request, one single response. To create a flow, you just need to give it the URL. And optionally, it also may have some outputs and some operations. The outputs are, in the outputs, you tell Radar what information to extract from the response, while the operations either run some arbitrary actions after receiving the response, or it links to other flows, and it can also be conditional. Depending, let's say we receive a HTTP status code 200, we go to flow A, otherwise we go to flow B. Now, here's how two such flows interact with each other in Radar. Basically, each flow needs to have one request and one response. The request may optionally have some inputs, while the response might optionally return some outputs. And also, each flow also optionally can have some operations, which I said can either run some arbitrary actions when you receive the response, or tell Radar which flow to go to next. Another important part is the outputs from previous flows can be used as inputs for the next ones. This is how Radar keeps track of the state. That's how you share information between the flows. So basically, to create a flow, you just need to give it one request. And now let's take a look at the request. The only required parameter is the URL. Everything else is optional. You specify the HTTP method via the class method. You can also give it some cookies, headers, some parameters to append to the URL, or use HTTP body data, either in URL encoded format, in JSON, in multipart, and so on. And each of those can contain plugins. I'm going to explain plugins in the next slide, but those are used to share data between flows. So plugins are small pieces of code. They can be used as inputs and or outputs. You can use them to extract data from somewhere. Let's say from the user, from the terminal, or from a file. You can also extract some data from the response body, or from JSON, from the URL query, and so on. You use plugins also to manipulate data, encode it, decode it, do some string manipulations, and so on. Some of those can also be nested, and the user can write their own plugins without touching Radar core. Now operations. They run after the response is received, as I said, and they can execute arbitrary code. But the most important thing why operations exist is to control the information flow, to tell Radar where to go to next, and whether HTTP process completed successfully or it failed. Operations can also run other operations conditionally. As I said, it can check for the status code, it can check for response body matching something, and so on. you can even run real Haiyan code by using the Lisp code thing. And the users can write own operations without touching the core. Now, let's talk about flow graphs. It's a really relatively recent feature introduced in Rider, and they're used to chain multiple flows together until the end and or until success or failure operations return. Basically, they're just a pointer to the first flow. But optionally, you can also have the second flow, which just run an additional test to see if the process completed successfully or not. And you can simulate complex system using this architecture. And as you can see in the screenshot, you can have independent flows like flow 9, which only returns success or failure, or you can have complex networks of flows, some with a flow graph pointing to it, and others without. Some will return success or failure, others will not. And from Rider command line, you can run either a flow, a flow graph, or any combination of flows and flow graphs as you want. And if you run some flow without having some inputs already, Rider will prompt you for those inputs manually. So you can run from Rider command line. Let's say we start from flow 4, then go to flow 9, then run flow graph 2 until the end, till success, then run flow 3, and so on. Any kind of combination of flows and flow graphs is allowed. And this enables us to test very complex scenarios. Now I'm going to show you the demo. So for this demo, I prepared, I automated some processes within OWASP Juice Shop, which is an intentionally vulnerable application. For this first example, I automated the registration and the login part. And here you can see approximately how that looks like. To actually register a user, we need to send three different requests. So first is to get the security questions, the next one is to register a user, and the last one is to submit the security answer. So we created those three flows and have the register flow graph pointing to the first one. And additionally, we also have the login flow, which needs just one step. And as you can see, some of those flows return success and failure, others do not. So now you can see OWASP Juice Shop, and I'm just going to show you that I don't have the user yet. So now it will fail. But yeah, let's take a look at the code first. So here's the project files for this for Juice Shop. And the first one, the main file, is mostly just creating some plugins. So basically, the first one is just a string. We created the base URL for OWASP Juice Shop. Then we have here some plugin which will extract the question from JSON. Here below we have some other JSON plugins. Those three variable plugins, email, password, and dasr, will be the information we created about the user here below. And we have two more plugins. One is a cookie, which is created from a previously defined auth token plugin, and it will be named token. And the last plugin is a regular expression, which will just match some HTML code and print it. You'll see later, it's for another attack. So basically here I created the plugins. Now let's see the registration. So here we have in total three flows. And the first one is we'll get the security question. And I'm using with base URL here, it's a macro, just appends the base URL we defined to this one. And it will extract the question, it will print it, and go to the next stage. Now for the next flow, we send a post request with the JSON body and all the credentials here inside. It will extract the user ID, and then it will check for regular expression in the response body to see if the email is already registered or not. So if we try to register twice with the same email, it will fail and it will print this. Otherwise, it will print the whole body and go to the last flow. So here we send a post request with the JSON body, and it's very similar, except it will check for HTTP status 201, which means the user was created. Otherwise, it will return failure. And here at the end, we have the flow graph, which points to the very first flow here. Now let's look at the login on. This is simpler. So basically, we have just a post request with the email and password, and it will output the auth token. Then it will check if the status code was 401, which means the login failed. Otherwise, it will print it. Yeah, and return success. Now, here's how this configuration looks like in Radar. Basically, you can see JuiceShop, the project. Here you can see the file names. So for each file name, you can see all the flows and flow graphs are in red, and that are configured in this file. So by default, we also get the default flow graph, which is just to run the very first flow. It's just for convenience purposes. But now let's run it. So I want to register, then login. And as you can see, it got the security questions and printed them, registered the user, printed the response body, submitted the security answer, and created the user successfully. Then it ran the flow login, which printed the token for us, the auth token. If we try to run it again, it will fail because we cannot register a user with the same email twice. Now if we go back here, then we already logged in and it works. So that was it for the first demo. Now the second demo will actually exploit an SQL injection in JuiceShop. When you log in JuiceShop, the email input field is vulnerable to SQL injection. And we are testing this with the Radar, like you can see here. There's just one single flow, which points to itself, and there's a flow graph pointing to it. So now let's take a look at the code to see what exactly that looks like for SQL injection. So that's it. We have this login SQLi flow, which will send a post request and with a JSON body, but here you can see that instead of sending some string for the email, it will prompt us the user for the payload. This is how we're gonna test it. So it will also output the auth token, print the response body, and check for status code. If status code is 200, that means we logged in successfully. Otherwise, it will go to itself. So it will run in a loop otherwise. Now let's see how this looks like. SQLi test. Yeah, so if we just input some random value, it will give us back invalid email or password, which is as expected. But if we include a SQL code, we will see that there is some error, some SQL error. And I'm not gonna explain you how all of this works. I'm just gonna use the solution for now. And we can see the login process completed successfully. We got the token and we authenticated as the admin user. Now for the last example. This one is a little bit more complicated because you need to chain multiple things together. The ultimate goal here is to exploit a stored cross-site scripting issue, which can be found in the change username flow here. Basically, when you change the username, you can use some XSS attacks inside this field. But you cannot exploit it because of the so-called content security policy header configured here. But this can also be bypassed with another vulnerability in JuiceRob, which is why we have the second CSP test thing. And I'm going to show you all of this into the details very soon. But first, to actually run those, we need the auth token. So we can get them either by using the regular login or the SQLi test. Both of them return the auth token, as you already saw. So now let's look at the code. Here's for the XSS. And so basically, we have two flows here and one flow graph. The flow graph points to the first flow. So basically, the first one will just query the user profile and print the part of the HTML code which we are interested in. And the second one will submit a post request with a username, changing the username. And it will also use the prompt thing to ask us in the terminal line which username we want to have. And it will run in a loop. So from the first request, it will go unconditionally to the second one. And from the second one, it will go unconditionally to the first one. It will just run two flows in a loop infinitely. Now for the content security policy one, we have also two flows and one flow graph pointing to the first one, but here's a little bit different. So basically, we request the profile page, we print the content security policy header here, and we check if the user is satisfied with the result. If the answer is yes, the process returns success. Otherwise, it goes to the next flow to change picture URL. And here it will just submit this thing with what we told it in the prompt right here. And for a reason you'll understand very soon, we need to wait for the server to time out 30 seconds. So to do this, I just use the Lisp code to run, to import the time library from Python and sleep for 30 seconds. Then I go to the back to the first flow. So this will run also in a loop. Now let's look at how this actually looks in practice. So the first step could be either login or SQLi test, which I've showed before also gets us back this token. But since I don't want to do the SQL injection attack again, I'm just going to use login, it's faster. The second one was CSP test and cross-site scripting test. And I guess that's going to work. Let's see. Yeah, so first, it printed the existing content security policy header. And this doesn't work for us because we need one more attribute here. We need unsafe inline. We need to add new attribute. So I'm not satisfied with the result. And oops, sorry. Let's repeat that. Yeah, so now it asks for the image URL which will upload, which will change the user avatar. Just give me a second. I'm going to do something. So now we give the server an invalid URL, but at the end we have appended the actual attributes that we want. And the server will try to get this URL, which is why we need to wait for it to time out. And now in a few seconds it will time out, and you will see that despite the invalid URL, we will still get the content security policy header updated. here. So it changed to what we wanted. So now hopefully it will work. And I'm satisfied with the result. Now let's take a look at the cross-site scripting thing. So basically, right now, you won't see anything interesting. But if I use test username, you will see my string here. So basically, this field is vulnerable to cross-site scripting. And we can try the regular alert. And you will see that it gets filtered. So we need to bypass this filter as well. And I'm just going to use the solution, since I don't have time to explain it all here. I'm going to print document.cookie. And I guess that works. And if you go to the profile page, you should see the cookies in the alert box. I hope. Why is it so slow? I don't know what's going on. Ah, yes. So here it is. And, that's basically it. That's all for the demo part. Hope you like it. So what's next? Basically, right now, the documentation part of Radar is incomplete. There are still many changes which have been done, but has not been actually reflected into the documentation. After that, I need to focus on the way users interact with the Radar. So basically, right now, the debugging features are still missing. And it's also a very limited command line interface. I think one great addition would be to have a REPL, so read, eval, print loop. Basically, instead of running, changing the source code and running Radar from the command line, you could do all of this in real time. Another interesting thing that I've experimented with was using GPT-4 to actually generate HAI files from natural language. Basically, it almost worked. It was like 80% correct, but there are some errors which and does not allow it to run. And if anyone knows how to train it and is willing to help me with the large language models, I will accept my, your help. And I'm also interested in adding some new features. So basically, the fuzzing part was kind of working at the beginning, but now with a lot of architectural changes, it broke completely. So I need a properly functioning fuzzing mechanism here. I also want to have Radar keep track of the sessions so that it can recall or reuse previously seen inputs and or outputs. I also want to implement more macros to make it simpler to actually write the configuration files. And last but not least, I'm also interested in integrating Radar with other tools, which will benefit from having something like this. Now, I admit, Radar has some big limitations. It has a relatively steep learning curve. It already assumes that people already know finite state machines and are comfortable using Lisp, Python coding. And with Lisp, it's a thing that many people are just scared of those Lisp parentheses everywhere. So I hope it won't be a big issue. But there's also a very limited community support. Radar is still a recent tool. There are not so many people using it yet. And it's also the I'm only working and testing it on Linux. I don't know about the compatibility with other operating systems. I haven't tested it. So Now to end the presentation, I want to say that Radar is not just a toy anymore. It can be used for complex real-life systems. I've already used it for a lot of stuff during my job for penetration testing. But there's still a lot of work to do and room for improvement. And if you are interested in helping or learning more about it, feel free to look into those links and contact me. And now I'm open for the questions. No questions? I can't hear anything.
Let's go. You?
Oh, yeah. Hi. You said earlier that you were interested in not so much earlier, that is, you were interested in integrating with other tools. Do you mean like integrating with Zap and adding Radar as an optional authentication provider, or would this not be an option?
Can you repeat, please? I didn't get it, the last part.
If it would be possible to write a plugin for Zap to use Radar as the authentication method, so that Radar does the authentication and then Zap does the scanning?
We are already in talks with the Zap developers about this, but we still haven't made any progress yet, so it's still in planning.
Thank you. Perfect.
Yeah. That's it, I guess. Okay, thank you very much.